morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, February 7th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS urges Senegal's political class to urgently restore the country's electoral calendar.
ECOWAS is saying that there should be re-establishment of the electoral calendar that will take into cognizance the constitution of Senegal and also the protocols of ECOWAS.
Doctors Without Borders say one child dies every 2 hours in Zamzam displaced people's camps in Sudan. The East African crude oil pipeline faces fresh hurdles. Nigerian authorities voice concern as the rising cost of living sparks protests.
President has intervened in that sector to provide grace, to provide fertilizer to farmers, to bring additional acreage in order to increase the output and thereby bring down prices.
And the WHO says at least 4 million girls are at risk of undergoing female genital mutilation each year. Those stories plus our Black History Month presentation are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has urged what it calls the political class in Senegal to urgently restore the country's electoral calendar in accordance with Senegal's constitution. This after President Macky Sall abruptly postponed the February 25, 2024 presidential election and the parliament followed on Tuesday by pushing the polls to December. In a communique on Tuesday, ECOWAS called on Senegal's stakeholders to shun violence and other actions that may further disturb the peace and stability of the country. Abdel Fattahou Moussa is the ECOWAS Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security. He tells me that the decision by President Macky Sall and the Senegalese parliament goes against the fundamental principles of the sub-regional organization.
ECOWAS is saying that there should be re-establishment of the electoral calendar that will take into cognizance the constitution of Senegal and also the protocols of ECOWAS so that we are not outside the realm of the law.
When you say the protocols of ECOWAS, what is happening in Senegal? Does it infringe on the protocols of ECOWAS?
Yeah, some experts indicate that because 6 months to elections, you cannot sort of change the laws governing electoral processes and constitutional processes in a country. And what we are seeing is that what the parliament decided in the wee hours of today also fall under that situation where the protocols of ECOWAS on changing the law of the constitution within 6 months of the election have been infringed. So we are cautioning the country to make sure that their own constitutions and the ECOWAS protocols are not violated by what is going on in Senegal today.
When ECOWAS says that Senegal should re-establish electoral calendar, the Parliament of Senegal has postponed the election by 10 months. So are you saying this electoral calendar, when it is re-established, should fall within the 10 months or go back to original date of the election?
The thinking of ECOWAS is that what the parliament has decided, we think it is against both the constitution of Senegal and also against the fundamental protocols of ECOWAS, which clearly state in a supplementary protocol on democracy and good governance that you cannot modify electoral laws or the constitution within 6 months to the elections unless with the approval of the majority of stakeholders. We feel that the decision of parliament does not meet the requirements of what the supplementary protocol says. So all we are saying is that Senegal should be within the laws of its own constitution and should not also violate the protocols of ECOWAS. Those are our two main demands.
While I have you on the line, I wanted you to talk to me also about what's happening in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Has there been any official response from ECOWAS to the decision of these three countries to leave ECOWAS?
Yeah, listen, we have responded to them because the very first statement they made was on TV in both Niger and in Bamako, saying that they were withdrawing. ECOWAS membership is not based on collective applications. So those three countries cannot apply to leave ECOWAS when they didn't apply collectively to join ECOWAS. They are also to be aware that you cannot withdraw from ECOWAS within a period of 12 months. So since then, each of the three countries has written to ECOWAS saying that they would want to withdraw. We said fine, but none of them has repeated the public declaration of the three countries that they are withdrawing from ECOWAS with immediate effect.
Abdel Fattah Moussa is the a commissioner for political affairs and security of the Economic Community of West African States. He was speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. The United States says it is deeply concerned by actions taken to delay Senegal's February 25 presidential election, which it says run contrary to Senegal's strong democratic tradition. A State Department statement issued on Tuesday said the U.S. was particularly alarmed by reports of security forces removing by force parliamentarians who oppose a bill to delay the election, resulting in a National Assembly vote that cannot be considered legitimate given the conditions under which it took place. The United States urges the government of Senegal to move forward with its presidential election in accordance with the constitution and electoral laws. The U.S. also calls on the Senegalese government to restore full internet access immediately and to ensure that freedoms of peaceful assembly and expression, including for members of the press, are fully respected. Nigerian authorities say they are worried after a protest broke out in two states over the rising cost of food on Monday. Finance Minister Olawale Idon said the government will try to bring down prices by increasing agricultural production. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
Hundreds of people took to the streets of central Niger State and northwest Kano State saying food costs are outpacing their incomes. They also said authorities are not doing enough to address the situation. Speaking in Abuja Monday during a meeting with a visiting German delegation, Finance Minister Olawale Edun said the government is concerned about the situation and working to fix the problem. He blamed the recent surge in food prices on rising demand, saying the only way to address the situation is to boost agricultural production.
The president has intervened in that sector to provide grains, to provide fertilizer to farmers, to bring additional acreage, rice, maize, wheat, and cassava under additional acreage, additional production, in order to increase the output and thereby bring down prices, and that will help bring down inflation.
Police authorities in the Niger State capital, Mina, said they dispersed the protesters using, quote, minimum force, end quote. But the demonstrators threatened to reconvene. For months, Nigerians have complained over the state of the economy, which has remained sluggish amid the government's reform policies. President Bola Tinubu announced bold economic reforms last May, including the scrapping of subsidies on fuel and the floating of the national currency, the Naira. Authorities say the policies will help restore Nigeria's economy in the long term, but acknowledged that initially there will be challenges. Economic analyst Isaac Boti agrees.
I feel that it will take some time. Policies don't yield results immediately. When we look at some of the programs and policies that government is rolling out, within the next 6 months, if they are truthful with their plans and implementations, Nigeria should begin to see some changes.
Felix Morka is the National Publicity Secretary of the APC.
This is a monoproduct economy that shouldn't be a monoproduct economy for a population of over 200 million people. We can't simply put all of our eggs in a basket of crude oil sales, especially when we are not able to sustain the kind of productive level that can support our economy.
Nigeria is working hard to resume local refining of fuel. In December, authorities announced that all four refineries will undergo rehabilitation to restart operations by the end of 2024. Experts say if that happens, it will address Nigeria's problems significantly. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 7th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Amid a nine-month war in Sudan's North Darfur state, the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, MSF, reports one child dies every 2 hours in Zamzam Displaced People's Camp. Before the conflict, the health system was supported by UN agencies, but has now halted abruptly. MSF's Claire Nicolet tells viewers Nabil Biagio the situation in Zamzam camp is catastrophic, estimating 13 children die daily.
The situation is really deteriorating a lot since the last month. So we managed to do this nutritional assessment, and we do also mortality at the same time to try to understand a bit better the situation. So we found that indeed the malnutrition rates are absolutely crazy, meaning that for severe acute malnutrition, we are up to 7 when it's more than triple the emergency rate, as well for the lactating and pregnant women, absolutely crazy. So we saw that the reality of Zamzam come today is completely catastrophic. Also, mortality is really, really high, really higher than, like 3 times higher as well than the emergency threshold.
I see. And roughly how many people are housed at Zamzam?
Okay, so the numbers of Zamzam has been really changing, and we saw lots of new arrivals recently, especially from the south, Nyala and other cities, which have been really highly targeted and with lots of fighting. So we believe now with the current numbers, we are higher than 300,000 people inside Zamzam camp. So it's really a city. Yeah? It's really completely a city, and that's why we believe as well that we just see the tip of the iceberg of the reality.
And your report mentions that the health system in North Darfur previously was supported by UN agencies and has come to an abrupt stop. Could you elaborate on the effects of this halt on the healthcare services available to displaced people in Zamzam camp?
Yes, Al-Fashir used to be a very important, and North Darfur in general, used to be a very important humanitarian hub. So, yes, there were a lot of actors, UN agencies, international NGOs, etc. Unfortunately, when April arrived, almost everybody evacuated, and almost no one stayed. MSF France stayed, and we continue to work as much as possible. But since April, already the needs were crazy, and of course we couldn't manage and respond to all these needs. And really, we are almost alone at the moment to respond. Of course, Ministry of Health is still here, but obviously there is really almost just one hospital, not almost, one hospital was still working that we are supporting, and then almost no primary health care at all. The situation is deteriorating also because food is not coming in. And this is one of the, of course, the main problem of these malnutrition rates.
That's Claire Nicolette of the medical charity Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio. The East African crude oil pipeline, ECOB, is facing fresh hurdles after several insurance companies reportedly opted out of insuring the project following pressure from climate activists who argue that the project poses significant pollution and human rights risks. The 1,443-kilometer pipeline from western Uganda to the Tanzania Indian Ocean port of Tanga is planned to pass through areas of sensitive ecological importance, including national parks and wildlife reserves. Dekins Kamugisha is the executive director of the Kampala-based Africa Institute for Energy Governance. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that these organizations are trying to make sure that this project does not destroy livelihoods of Ugandans and the country's critical biodiversity.
Of course, we are still in court. We are still organizing communities to ensure that they reject any attempts by investors of the ECOP to allow that pipeline to pass in the water catchment of Lake Victoria, to allow the oil activities in the Machon Falls National Park. So the communities are still resisting those attempts. We are still mobilizing financial institutions and the insurance companies not to fund the project. And indeed, many of the banks and insurance companies are still saying no. But of course, you still have Totaro and the government of Uganda still pushing. We've seen a number of decisions being made, but we still hope that our efforts are going to ensure that this project does not destroy our people and it does not destroy our critical biodiversity.
We understand some insurance companies have pulled out of the project, given your concerns. But have you had dialogue with the government itself to make sure that environmental concerns are taken care of?
We've really had a number of discussions and meetings with government, with the companies. But as you know, government of Uganda, it prides in using impunity. A number of us have been arrested, have been put in detention, claiming that we are stopping investments. So instead of them actually accepting to discuss and ensure that we can come up with a settlement or a strategy that can ensure that, yes, if they want the project, that project should be done in a manner that it does not violate people's rights, it does not endanger our critical ecosystems. The government is always trying to use fear, harassment, intimidation, arrests, detentions, not to allow the people who are saying, no, you must discuss, you must save our people, you must save the environment. So even when we try to dialogue, we try to meet, it is still a very big challenge for government to accept those meetings.
The government, according to the government officials, are making progress in getting financing, at least the financing part of the project. Do you think the government could see bulldoze through the project without addressing your concerns?
Of course, we know companies like Totaro is a very rich company. We know the government of Uganda is desperate to start production of oil. And we know that because of that desperation, they can accept even the most confused and very complicated terms. So we know if they allow the companies, they give the companies very good terms, they can proceed with the project at the expense of Ugandans. And that's why we are engaging with Ugandans, empowering Ugandans to understand, to appreciate the consequences of proceeding with a project that is financially and environmentally not tenable.
That's Dekins Kamugisha, Executive Director of the Kampala-based Africa Institute for Energy Governance. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. Over 200 million girls and women alive today have undergone female genital mutilation, or FGM, in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, where the procedure is commonly practiced. This is according to the World Health Organization, which says 28 of the 30 countries where FGM is prevalent in Africa. Marie Ojiambo reports.
Female genital mutilation, FGM, is mostly carried out on young girls between infancy and the age of 15. The practice has no health benefits for girls and women and instead causes severe health complications, among them difficulties in giving birth and increased risk of newborn deaths. WHO's Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says his agency helps countries train health workers to treat complications from genital mutilation in primary care settings.
WHO is committed to helping countries build capacity to provide health care and support the survivors of female genital mutilation and work with communities to prevent it. 4 million girls are at risk of this harmful practice each year. It harms the health and well-being of women and girls. It is a violation of their human rights.
Under the theme Her Voice, Her Future, investing in survival-led movements to end female genital mutilation, The WHO says grassroots movements are key when it comes to fighting this scourge.
Health workers in countries where this practice occurs may be survivors themselves. They know the trauma and pain it causes. Many have turned that pain into advocacy and are speaking out against female genital mutilation. We stand with survivors to hear their voices, to ensure they have the care they need, and to support their efforts to stop FGM.
In East and Southern Africa, FGM is facing obstacles such as community beliefs and cultural practices, as millions of girls are at risk of undergoing the practice. The WHO report indicates that in several settings, there is evidence that healthcare providers are involved in performing FGM due to the belief that the procedure is safer when medicalized. Surum Ipato Korema, the chairperson of the Anti-FGM Board of Kenya, says all women must be involved in public education efforts to end the tradition.
Without engaging survivors in the campaigns, as the board, we cannot go anywhere. Because when you go to the grassroots, 90% of women are survivors of FGM.
The World Health Organization says treatment of health complications from FGM is substantial. UNFPA Global Coordinator for the FGM Trust Fund, Wissal Ahmed, says this should be a reason enough for policymakers to rethink about ending FGM.
In fact, the World Health Organization estimates that the health system cost for its complications is around $1.4 billion per year. So this amount of money, it's a very strong case for governments, because this is really an additional amount of money for already stretched health systems that are not really necessary if this was prevented.
The United Nations Population Fund says countries in East Africa with a high prevalence of FGM include Somalia with 98%, followed closely by Ethiopia at 65%, Kenya at 21%, Tanzania 10%, and Uganda at 0.3%. The report indicates that FGM was higher in the border areas of Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. They say this is because if a country or a county has stiff law against FGM, they can cross borders to areas that may still tolerate the practice. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in San Francisco.
It is time now for our Black History Month and African History presentation for today, February 7th. On this day, 1926, the first Negro History Week was observed. It was created by Dr. Carter G. Woodson and later changed to Black History Month in 1976. Also on this day, 1883, pianist U.B. Blake was born in Baltimore, Maryland. In 1921, he wrote the musical Shuffle Alone, which became the most successful black show on Broadway. On this day in 1871, Acorn College was founded in the state of Mississippi. It is the oldest historically black land-grant institution in the United States and the second oldest state-supported institution in the state of Mississippi. The school became Acorn Agricultural and Mechanical College in 1878, initially serving only black males until women were enrolled in 1895. In 1974, the school became Acorn State University, after Governor William L. Waller signed a bill granting university status to Acorn and other state-supported colleges. Did you know that Madame C.J. Walker was the first female African-American millionaire? Walker became a highly successful businesswoman by selling her own brand of cosmetics. She used much of her money to help the needy. On this day, 1984, Michael Jackson was entered into the Guinness Book of World Records for selling 25 million copies of his album Thriller. And those are your Black History Month facts for today, February 7th. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.